Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Book Cave. This is your host, Rick Croxton.
And Art Sippo.
And joining us today is Wynn Eckert. How you doing, Wynn?
I'm fine. Thanks, guys. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. We've got some pretty interesting topics to cover today, like crossovers and Woe Newton and what else, Art?
Well, there's an awful lot of stuff that has come out about crossovers recently, and we do have some crossover-relevant material that's being published. Black Coats is going to be publishing some new volumes in their Tales of the Shadowmen series and the Nyctalope, and we'll touch on some of those. But the real thing we're going to be covering is crossovers. This is an outgrowth of Phil Farmer's original Woe Newton family. It is an extremely ambitious project, and it has been the baby of Wynn Eckert. Wynn has been a big fan now for quite some time of Phil Farmer's Woe Newton stuff. He started the first website that was dedicated to Woe Newton studies, and he is the author of a two-volume series entitled Crossovers, A Secret Chronology of the World. So, Wynn, why don't you tell us a little bit about crossovers, the two-volume series, what got you into it, you know, and how it developed, you know, go ahead and let loose.
All right. Thanks, Art. Well, this will probably be a bit of a long-winded answer, so apologies in advance. But, yeah, I first got into Philip Jose Farmer's Woe Newton concept of a shared universe back in the mid-1970s. That concept is about a fictional genealogy of family members of related heroes such as Sherlock Holmes and Doc Savage and Tarzan and James Bond. And Phil Farmer postulated that they were all related through this event, a meteor, which landed in Woe Newton, England in 1795. And the meteor irradiated the people that were present, caused a mutation, and then there was a lot of inbreeding, and it produced sort of this slew of heroes and villains as well, like Professor Moriarty and Dr. Fu Manchu. So I got into this concept in the mid-1970s. Very shortly thereafter, I was really into comic books as well, and superhero comic books, you know, all the Silver Age stuff that was coming out at that time. But then this new comic that really appealed to me came out. And it was a very short issue. It was a serialized comic, and it was called The Rocketeer by Dave Stevens. And it had this great 1930s storyline and this beautiful art it was a whole nother world above the superhero comic books I was reading at the time. Well, the thing is, about the third serial installment into that series, I realized that the mysterious person who invented the Rocketeer's rocket pack, who was not named by Dave Stevens because he wasn't allowed to use this character due to copyright concerns, the inventor was Doc Savage. And you could very clearly see that it was Doc Savage from the way he was drawn and the way he spoke, and his five aides, Monk and Long Tom and Ham and Rennie and Johnny, the archaeologist. They were all there. And you could tell from the way they were drawn and they were acted that it was Doc and his Amazing Five. And that was a crossover. And that was really my first experience with true crossovers other than the whole Woe Newton crossover concept that Phil Farmer had done himself. So I got to thinking, well, where would this take place in the timeline of Doc's adventures? Because I also had in the back of Phil Farmer's book, Doc Savage, His Apocalyptic Life, there was a timeline, a chronology that Phil did of Doc's adventures. And yes, we're aware that maybe now looking back on it 30 or 40 years later, that may not have been the perfect chronology of Doc's adventures, but it was the best that Phil Farmer could do at the time, given his available resources, the fact that he had lost many of his Doc Savage pulps in a flood, and so on. So anyway, there was this timeline. And I thought to myself, well, here's a Doc Savage adventure that's not in the timeline. It's The Rocketeer. Where does it take place? And I looked it up, and it actually fit in Phil's timeline. And from that point forward, I actually started making a handwritten chronology of crossover stories that I would come across that I thought could fit into this timeline and would work well in this shared Woe Newton world. Put that aside for a while, but in the late 1990s, mid to late 1990s, I got onto the internet and I realized, hey, there's nothing about Wold Newton really on the internet. I think there may be some Wold Newton family FAQ somewhere, which was sort of half accurate, but there's no Wold Newton website. So I started a Wold Newton fan website, and I decided not only would I host some articles, which actually came afterwards, but the first thing I was going to do was I was going to put this very rudimentary timeline up, this crossover chronology. So it was a chronology of different crossover stories that I felt kind of fit into this shared universe concept that Phil had actually started. And from there it grew. Eventually it became so large that I stopped updating the website. It just became too overwhelming to continue to update the website all the time, and I converted everything into a massive, massive Word document. And from that point forward, converted it into a manuscript. Black Coat Press expressed interest in publishing it, and gosh, over almost 15 years, 10, 11, 15 years later, after I started the website, the two-volume books that Art, you referred to, Crossovers 1 and 2, came out last year. They're each over 450 pages, which just amazes me when I hold them in my hands because they're like encyclopedias. Mm-hmm. And I can't believe that it's grown to this. But, yeah, that's what Crossovers is. It's really now the crossover universe, and it's a shared universe of all kinds of different crossover stories where characters have met each other in a way that makes sense when you look at the universe as a whole. So I don't include things that don't make sense if they sort of violate the principles of what this shared universe and this shared continuity is about. So that's my long-winded answer, Art.
Very good. Well, it's been it has compilations of all kinds of things. There is there's Lovecraftian material in it. There's stuff from Robert E. Howard. You've got film material as well. What kind of criteria did you use for, you know, the inclusion of things? You've even got such things as the Mexican wrestler movies.
Absolutely.
The Mexican wrestler superheroes. How did you make the choice on including some of these things?
Great question. So at the heart of it, the crossover universe, from my perspective, is a continuity that could be the real world. Now, we all know with the Lovecraftian stuff and that it's not the real world. But when I look out my window, I don't see, you know, super teams flying all over the place, superhero teams, and I don't find, you know, the city of San Diego destroyed by, you know, some kind of malevolent, you know, supervillain from Marvel Comics or DC Comics. I look out my window and I say, oh, well, maybe Cthulhu really is out there. I don't know. I can't tell in the real world, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Not really sure, right? Or, you know, maybe Dracula, you know, can come, you know, and fly through my window as a mist at night. I hope not, but maybe that could happen. You know, so it doesn't really violate that sense of being able to pretend that this is all real and that it's sort of a real world. It's one of the reasons why I'm much more attracted to just the pulp genre in the first place. These guys, these heroes, could be real world heroes. You could almost think of a world in which there really could be a Doc Savage, right? You really can't think of a world in which there could be a Superman with the level of superpowers that Superman exhibits in the current comic books. You just really can't think of that's much more science fictional, much more its own universe, the DC universe. So that's really my main criteria, Art, is could it fit in this continuity without straining the believability? You know, so in terms of some of the things that you've mentioned, it's not really necessarily the media, whether it's a film or a book or a comic book, that is the constraint. It's really about the story. So now that said, I've tried to set down some ground rules and some boundaries around how this all works from my perspective. So I don't include fan fiction. There's a wealth of fan fiction on the internet, all sorts of fan fiction sites, people writing crossover stories all the time. There's no way I could ever research all that and include it. So what I include is if these are characters that are still protected by copyright, then I only include the licensed or authorized works, you know, or if they're pastiches as of Sherlock Holmes, then the way I approach it is this a Sherlock Holmes story that fits into continuity, or does it violate the continuity or contradict something in some way? I also don't use real historical characters as links for crossovers. So, for instance, if Sherlock Holmes met Theodore Roosevelt and some other character met Theodore Roosevelt, that's interesting information to me, but that doesn't automatically create a crossover link because, you know, anybody could have met Theodore Roosevelt and lots of people fought Hitler, right? So when you have all the pulp heroes fighting Hitler, that doesn't necessarily mean that therefore they're all linked together. Besides, there are plenty of other good fictional links that can be used. I mentioned Superman, and I do include superhero comic book crossovers, but I have a pretty detailed and in-depth set of rules on how that can work and how we sort of postulate that these are very fictionalized and exaggerated versions that are in the comic books versus the version of the superhero that actually takes place in the crossover universe. So imagine Superman at his 1938 levels, and he could leap an eighth of a mile, as opposed to literally flying. That's the sort of Superman that I see included in the crossover universe, and even that is straining the bounds of believability, I admit. But very low-powered superheroes, not exaggerated, and no world-changing, world-destroying events. Those are sort of my main criteria. And then I do provide a lot of references where there are contradictions that I view as more minor contradictions, where people have actually taken a look at those contradictions and maybe written articles or come up with theories to reconcile those contradictions.
Oh, very good. Yeah, I know way back when in the early 1960s, I had felt that the superhero comics had started spiraling way out of reality into not even a science fiction universe, but a fantasy universe. And it's interesting, you and I had very similar attitudes towards the pulps. The discovery of Doc Savage, for me, and opening up into the pulp genre, was a way of grounding hero stories in something much more realistic. So I very strongly identify with it. You know, I remember back in 1962 when I was 9 years old, being all bummed at how unrealistic comic books were.
You know, Art, I'd much rather read an Ian Fleming novel about James Bond, you know, using his wits and, you know, his Beretta and, you know, his diving knife to escape some kind of trap, and then reading a comic book with Superman being able to fly through the air and cremate something with his X-ray or his heat ray vision, you know. I mean, that's boring.
Yeah, there's too much of the Deus Ex Machina in the device. Yeah. It's too easy. Yeah,
and of course, there's Superman's favorite superpower. There's super ventriloquism.
You know what, Rick? I like super freeze breath. That's a good one.
It's like Superman. I think you need a Tic Tac.
Yeah. But you know, we were talking with somebody on the show like last month or so, and in they were talking about how the superhero universes had become Julie Schwartz'd. Julie Schwartz had really taken these things and had driven them out to the extremes. And we can see that in the 1970s, there was an attempt to swing things back. They cut back on Superman's power. They cut back on Wonder Woman's power, actually making her a normal person and like a spy. And that was a big thing during that period. We also had a lot of pulp themes coming into comics, which has been food for crossovers. The Xi Qing storyline,
Right.
Where he's the son of Fu Manchu and bringing in Dr. Petrie and Dennis Nealon-Smith and all. So I love
those comics. They're some of my favorites.
Yeah. And you know, some of the kids today, they don't remember those comics, I tell you.
And of course there was the two Batman issues. You know, crossing over with the Shadow.
Yep, right. Definitely. Two issues of the Batman crossing with the Shadow, and actually when DC had the rights to the Shadow at that time with the Batman crossovers, they also had the rights to the Avenger.
Right.
And they did a really, really great Shadow Avenger crossover in one of the issues of the Shadow. That's the kind of stuff I like. Great art by Michael Kaluta, E.R. Cruz. Man, that was the heyday. Nice stuff.
Mm-hmm. And things have changed. They've spiraled out. We now have zombie universes and what's very odd is that every 2 or 3 years we have another major cataclysm that undermines all of reality, and the universes are changed forever. And
until the next time.
Continuity. Oh yeah, and it's kind of funny. We had some of the women on who are doing the stories in Chicks and Capes.
Oh yeah,
anthology. And these women have been working in the comic industry for quite some time and written a lot of things. And in one of the stories, I think it's Elaine Lee? I think that's right.
Right.
She has one of the characters say, you know, I thought I would be, you know, fighting bank robbers as a superheroine, but it turns out that I just end up fighting a bigger and badder bad guy, and we just end up fighting amongst ourselves. And that's kind of what it degenerates into.
Yeah.
It becomes, you know, all of the stories turn into Ragnarok, the Battle of the Gods. And the original idea of a hero in a real world dealing with real threats and real villains just kind of disappears. And I think the pulp universe in particular keeps that from happening. It generally keeps things down to a good scale. Dent was very good at constructing that for Doc Savage. Constructing things that looked like they were extraneous and weirdly weird menaces, and then finding out that they were mundane but still, you know, very interesting, still interesting MacGuffins and problems.
I couldn't agree more. And you know, Art, these events, as the comic book companies are calling them, that they cease to be events when they happen over and over and over again. They cease to be noteworthy. You know, if you were to have one ultimate confrontation with all the pulp heroes against some kind of, you know, unimaginable menace, that would be a heck of a lot of fun. But you can only do it once.
Exactly.
You know, you can't have it happen over and over and over again. It just gets old and tiresome.
Yeah. So, you know, that's... I see I think part of the reason why pulp has become a little bit more popular now, while there are so many different pulp companies publishing and new stories and interest, is because we're getting back to stories about that are a little bit on a smaller scale that are still engaging people's imagination but not going hog wild.
Right, and they're about the characters. Once you do these you know, all of the heroes versus the worst menace ever, it's not about the characters themselves anymore. It's only about this universe, world, timeline changing confrontation. It becomes about the continuity in the universe rather than the characters.
Exactly.
It's getting to the point where it's beyond what you can actually realistically imagine something happening.
Yeah.
And where the pulps, you have somebody say, yeah, I want to take over the United States, or I want to take over this country, or whatever. In the comics, forget the world, they want the universe.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, getting back to the crossovers, the book itself, boy, you have things in here that not only from the English literature, but you've got a lot of things from foreign literature as well. I've noticed you have an awful lot of French. I think that's in part thanks to folks like Jean-Marc Officier and black coats. I wanted to ask you, what kind of limits did you have on the fiction from other nations? Was there anything in particular that you looked for or used?
You know, there wasn't really any limit, and to be honest with you, Art, I didn't want this to be completely U.S. or even Great Britain centric, and I fortunately did have a couple of folks at my disposal who provided me with a lot of information. So as you said, Jean-Marc Lafissier, who is French and is the publisher of Black Coat Press, provided me with a lot of information. A lot of crossover information. A lot of this information was already available on his own French Wold Newton Universe website. I'm sure you guys know of Jess Nevins. Noted pulp scholar. Jess and I have had a nice correspondence for years and years and years. And in fact, he had an article in one of my prior books, Myths for the Modern Age. Anyway. Jess has done a lot of research himself on international pulps and dime novels, and whenever he found crossovers, he would send me his notes. So this is definitely not just the work in terms of research, pure research. It's definitely not the work of one single person, and I hopefully I captured that in the rather lengthy acknowledgments. A lot of people have sent me a lot of information over the years. And then it really became my job to vet that information and to confirm it, to track it down, to make sure it was accurate. Now, in some cases, such as the case of Jess Nevins or Jean-Marc, I pretty much automatically treated them as an impeccable source that I didn't really need to cross-check or do any additional research, you know, that they've never steered me wrong before. Other folks might have seen my website, maybe kind of got what I was doing, but maybe not kind of gotten it completely, sent me some information, and in those cases, I definitely went out of my way to get the source material myself and double-check the reference, double-check the information, make sure it was absolutely accurate, so that it was really a labor-intensive process. But to get back to your question, about the international aspect of it. I actually wanted it to be as international as possible because the title is The Secret Chronology of the World. And there are heroes all over the world, heroes from Spain and Mexico, Turkey, the Far East, Japan, China. And I wanted the book to be reflective of that. And hopefully I've succeeded to at least some small extent. I'm sure that there's still a heavy emphasis on, you know, the United States and the English stories and characters, but hopefully there's also really a nice range of stories from other parts of the world as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's quite a good mix in the whole Wold Newton story. I think having a lot of active participation by writers in the Tales of the Shadowmen series has helped to keep that up as well.
They've been
contributing. I did want to ask you, now you actually have been to Wold Newton.
Yes.
And you have seen the monument. I think you've actually seen the asteroid itself that had fallen, haven't you?
Yes. Yes to both. I have been to Wold Newton. This was all in July 2009, so only a year and a half ago. I've been to the village of Wold Newton, which is in the Yorkshire Wolds, in the East Riding of Yorkshire, in England, which is, to orient people who may not have a map in front of them, is kind of on the east coast of England, not quite as far north as Hadrian's Wall. We spent a night at the Wold Cottage, which is now a lovely bed and breakfast. The Wold Cottage is the home of the gentleman who basically made the Wold Newton meteorite famous and publicized the fact that the meteorite had fallen from the sky. He's the one who erected the monument. His name was Major Edward Topham, And so we stayed in his home. We visited the monument. We visited the monument not once but twice. And then when we circled back and we're spending time in London again, because we started in London. When we were back in London, we visited the Museum of Natural History, the British Museum of Natural History, where they have the meteorite. Now, it was actually not on display. It's been on display for quite some time, but for whatever reason, at this point in time, it was not on display. Maybe they were, you know, refurbishing the exhibit or something. I don't quite remember. But we had a special appointment, and the folks who are expert in the meteors and the meteorites got out the Wold Newton meteorite for us. And we had a special showing in a room in the basement.
Wow.
And it was pretty amazing. Now we were not allowed to touch it, but there was a shard which had been previously cut off, which we were allowed to touch, and we had to wear special gloves because the oil from your hands can actually affect the stone. So
wow.
quite an amazing experience.
Wow, amazing.
And actually used my experience in visiting Wold Newton in a story which I've written, so which would be forthcoming later this year. So always use your experiences if you possibly can when writing.
Yeah, you know, of course, why they didn't want you to touch it, because they didn't want you to have superpowers.
Oh, that's true.
That's what it is.
Although maybe I got them just by being where it landed, you know, at the monument. You never know.
There you go.
So that's where the horns and the tail came from.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Now I seem to remember that in one of the stories, there was speculation that the Wold Newton meteorite may have been more than simply a meteorite and might actually have been an artifact. Am I remembering this correctly, or was this something that had been talked about?
You know, Art, I don't think that's a story. I think it's maybe something that we were just sort of speculating or chatting over, maybe at one of the PharmaCons,
mm-hmm.
And on one of our wild nights of speculation, one of our late nights sitting up with wine and beer and cigars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think it was mentioned on the show last time you was on.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it could have been. Yeah, I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory, but I will tell you this: I do think that there was more to the story of the meteorite falling and of those particular 18 people being in the village of Wold Newton, England, at the time that the meteor fell. I think there's more to that story than just pure coincidence.
Yes, and actually in one of your stories, gosh, I'm forgetting the title of it now. It was included in the Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer collection that was published last year. What was the title of that story?
That was Is He in Hell?
That's it. Is He in Hell? You kind of deal a little bit with speculation about that.
I do.
A very good story, by the way. Very enjoyable.
Thank you. Thanks. That's it's a Scarlet Pimpernel story. And it takes place in November 1795, which is 1 month before the meteorite landed in Wold Newton, which was December. And in 1795, really the Scarlet Pimpernel had almost retired. The main body of stories take place from about 1790 to 1792-93, thereabouts. There may have been one that took place in 1794, but the bulk of them were a couple years earlier. So I got to thinking, Phil had placed the Scarlet Pimpernel as one of the people at Wold Newton. Why was he there? What was going on with him? So Is He in Hell is really my attempt to... It's almost a prologue, if you will. It doesn't talk about those 18 people actually gathering at Wold Newton, but it talks about how the Scarlet Pimpernel got the idea to invite a group of people to one of his many homes, one of which is located near the village of Wold Newton.
Mm, very good. Because I've often wondered, when I read the original speculation by Phil that the Wall-Newton meteor was somehow responsible. You know, my old scientific bent came in. I said, well, you know, the ionizing radiation in and of itself wouldn't really have done that. It's too random. Something else must have happened. And I just kind of let it go. You just go with the flow.
Right.
But that's interesting. That's something that maybe someone will work with and examine in the future.
Yeah, that's a good point, Art. I'm not sure that I have enough of a scientific background to come up with a more realistic scientific explanation. I might leave that to you as the medical man. but what has intrigued me has really been, you know, why were they there and what was going on and what's the secret history behind that? And I do intend that to be a series of stories. Which may eventually morph into a novel or may just remain a series of very deeply interconnected stories. In fact, I actually already wrote the second story, which was in Tales of the Shadowman 8, which was a very short story, and kind of a side stream story, but nonetheless adds a little bit to the mythology. That one was called Nadine's Invitation, the invitation being the invitation to come visit Wall-Newton.
Ah, very good. Wow. So now, as we've said, Tales of the Shadowman has had a lot of Wall-Newton crossover material in it. Has anybody been, how do I put this delicately, editing that content, or have the writers pretty much been free rein on that?
As far as I know, Art, I think the writers are pretty much given free rein by Jean-Marc, and I don't think that Jean-Marc actually actively tells them to write a story that takes place in Wall-Newton continuity. I think it just so happens by virtue of the characters that are used and that have already been linked in that you can say that they take place in Wall-Newton continuity. Now, a couple of them absolutely out and out are intended to take place in Wall-Newton continuity, like my stories, for instance, you know, and a couple of others that have explicitly made use of Philip Jose Farmer's characters, even in disguise. So, you know, I think a couple of them haven't been intended to. I think the rest of them still fit in quite nicely, as I've documented them in crossovers. And then a couple of them really just don't fit in at all for various reasons. There's a continuity conflict, a chronological conflict or something like that just can't be reconciled. But even with those stories, I note those in an appendix to Volume 2, which covers basically a whole bunch of alternate universe crossover stories that don't fit into the main timeline. So I try to be as comprehensive as possible and make sure that everybody who's written a story that I'm aware of gets a mention. That said, there were definitely space limitations, and there are definitely things that I just didn't have space to cover. So maybe there will be a Volume 3 someday. I'm not sure. That might kill me, though.
Well, no, but it's something to look forward to for sure. I mean, as you say, these are very encyclopedic. It's got just about everything that you could imagine included in it. I was so pleased to see there were some esoteric storylines and some films that were actually favorites of mine that you included.
What films in particular? I'm curious what films.
Well, let's see. There were several of the old vampire films that you had.
Oh, like the Hammer ones, the Hammer films. Yeah.
You know, I loved those Hammer films, especially the ones with Christopher Lee as
Dracula.
Dracula. And gosh, you know, the other thing that I found was you had some of those old stories. There were a lot of Holmes pastiches that came out in the 1970s.
Yeah,
there was a whole bunch of them, and I was pleased to see that you had gotten those. If you remember, I think I sent you in one of the Laura Croft Tomb Raider novels.
Yep,
they had a piece that was relevant, I thought, to crossovers, and I remember writing to you about that, and you picked up on that one too. You already had that one in your database. Great.
Hopefully, now I'm looking at the acknowledgments, Art, to make sure. Yep, there you are. Okay, good. wanted to make sure that if you sent me something that I used it and paid attention to it. Yeah, the one of the Tomb Raider novels, and I'm not sure, there's a couple that are listed. One of them is pretty significant. It's called The Man of Bronze, which is a pretty interesting title given our interest in Doc Savage, although ultimately it's not Doc Savage related. But this the writer actually goes back, and the core of the mystery involves a bunch of folks back in the late 1700s or early 1800s, some of them who are the same people who Phil said must have been at Wold Newton. So he mentioned a Holmes, who would be an ancestor to Sherlock Holmes, a Quatermain from Haggard's Alan Quatermain. There's a Bond, who would be an ancestor of James Bond, a Templar, who would be an ancestor of the Saint, and so on. And so I actually had to figure out how to reconcile this novel with these pre-existing ancestors that Phil had already made up and make all that work together. So that was a fun. Is that the one you were referring to, Art, or was it a
That's
different
one? Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. And I think we have. I also think I have to interject here that Phil didn't really feel he had made this up.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Phil defended, as far as I know, that he was actually telling a true story.
When I speak about it, Art, I go back and forth. It's hard for me to remember, to be honest, to speak about it in those terms.
I definitely
do always try to remind people that this is all real, and right. these are biographies of real people, and these are real people who actually existed, and we're telling fictionalized versions of their adventures and so forth. And it's a fun game to play, and that actually arises from the Sherlockian game of analyzing all the Sherlock Holmes stories and reconciling all of the contradictions that Watson interjected into those stories, because, you know, we could just dismiss them and say, well, Conan Doyle, you know, wasn't very careful and created a lot of contradictions. Or you could say, no, Watson really wrote those stories, and, you know, in some instances he forgot to cover his tracks. In some instances he changed names on purpose, he moved dates around on purpose, and that's why there are all these contradictions in what is, at the end of it all, a biography of a real person, Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm. And I know you've seen the interviews in the special Moi Tarzan from the Belgian filmmaker.
Yes. And yes.
And Phil he sat there with his copy of Burke's Peerage with all his notes, swearing up and down that he had all the information right there. And the fun part about that is that Phil is talking in English, and they actually have somebody speaking over, and I think there are subtitles also in French.
Yeah.
So you can actually hear Phil talk about this himself.
Yep.
It was a wonderful piece of filmmaking, and I actually got a copy of it from the Amazon Francais. Because I have one of those multiple region DVD players.
Yeah,
and it'll play here, and so it was wonderful to watch.
I think you can watch it on the web, or at least that's how I watched it a couple years ago. I had to pay. And then you could only watch it for a limited amount of time, and then your password would turn off. Mm-hmm. So I actually don't have a copy, but I think it's still out there on the web. Maybe we could send out a link or something with the podcast afterwards.
Ah, that would be great. You know, and you can, as I said, last I had seen, it was still available out in Amazon Francais.
I might look into that.
You know, because you can get these DVD players that have a built-in converter and will be region negative.
Right.
And they don't cost any more than a regular DVD player. It's amazing.
That's the way to go.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've got all this stuff from England that I want to have here. because there were a lot of TV shows when I was stationed in England that I had really loved, and
right.
They started coming out on DVD, and they were only available in the British format, so it was just a necessity.
Art, I'm surprised. I'm surprised that you spent so much time in England, but never made it to Wold Newton.
You know, I had always wanted to, but it just never seemed to work out. While I was working with the British, we were running all over the country on the Alpha Helmet project, which was the new lightweight helmet, you know, that was 20 years ago, for the British Air Force and the Royal Navy. We never did just get a chance to go there. It's,
yeah.
as you know, it's very well off the beaten path, very far up towards Scotland.
Yep, it is.
And you've got to have a long commitment. The one trip I made that was the only one I really made that I wanted to was to go on Hay on Wye, which is the Welsh village of bookstores.
Okay.
It's all bookstores.
Wow.
And it's a fascinating place. There's all kinds of things. There's old stuff. There's new stuff. There's paperbacks. There's hardbacks. And I got quite a few interesting finds. One of the there was a funny story there when Kathy and I went. We were staying in the motel there in Wales, and as you know, the Welsh language is related to English, but just barely.
Yeah.
And they have almost no vowels. Everything's got five and six W's in it, and they have these enormous names that, you know, are pronounced like cluck, and it's 18 letters long. But anyway, we were sitting there watching TV, and they had one of these manga cartoons with the Japanese robots come on.
Right.
And I'm listening to it, and I said, oh, my gosh. This is a Japanese cartoon in Japanese. And then the cartoon was over, and it was part of one of the children's shows. And these people started speaking this weird language that sounded like Japanese, and it dawned on me that, no, these cartoons had been dubbed in Welsh.
Right.
But it was so alien that I couldn't make heads or tails of it.
I'm gonna contact you offline, Art, and get that information on all the bookstores, because I'm definitely planning another trip to the UK here in the next couple of years, and I'll have to check that out.
Ah, very good. Oh, yes, I can tell you where the places are.
Very good, very good.
Now we talked about Sherlock Holmes. We do have a Sherlock Holmes crossover anthology coming up, don't we?
We do. It's from Moonstone Books, edited by Howard Hopkins, who... you may know as probably the world's leading authority on The Avenger, and who has co-edited The Avenger anthologies with Moonstone. It's called Sherlock Holmes, The Crossovers Casebook. And it's got stories from several folks, names you might recognize. Martin Powell, who's done a lot of work for Moonstone and a lot of great comic book work on Sherlock Holmes dating all the way back to the 1980s. In fact, I think his first, and I apologies to Martin if this is not his first, but I believe his first graphic novel was Scarlet and Gaslight, which is a Sherlock Holmes Dracula crossover. He did a Sherlock Holmes Invisible Man crossover graphic novel, and a whole host of other Sherlock Holmes work. So definitely got the Holmes credentials there. Let me look up real quickly to see who else is in the book that people's names. Oh, well, there's Will Murray. He probably needs no introduction. Matthew Baugh, who is a pretty well-known Wold Newton and pulp writer. Joe from Moonstone, of course, is contributing, as well as Howard. Barbara Hambly has done many Holmes short stories.
Oh, yes. She did a marvelous original vampire story, actually, that I really enjoyed. She's a good mystery writer.
Yeah. She's definitely one of the best and has written some very good Holmes pastiches as well. And apparently the crossovers will include... Arsène Lupin, which makes a lot of sense, the French gentleman thief, Lawrence of Arabia, Calamity Jane, Houdini, The Thinking Machine.
Jacques Trial, yes.
Exactly. Apparently, Colonel Savage, who is being positioned as Doc Savage's father. I'm not sure whether that's, you know, the real Colonel, what was his name? Colonel Richard Henry Savage?
Richard Henry Savage.
Yeah.
He's one possibility. You know, right. There was a fellow named John Masterson that had a whole series of books on the Savage family over in England. One of the most famous ones, I believe, is Bhowani Junction was the name of it, was where the Thuggee cult was involved, and it described in detail how the Thugs would kill people and how they could modify the bodies so that they could be stored in very small spaces. And this is a whole series on Savages. I've got them collected back here in the in my vault. Figuring
in the vault.
Yeah. Somehow they'll be connected to the Doc Savage.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. It might be. If I'm not mistaken, I imagine that one is the Will Murray contribution, which probably makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
And then there's Sexton Blake, which is my own crossover contribution. So and it's actually a couple of crossovers, not just Sexton Blake, although he's the most prominent. In my story, Holmes meets and works with Sexton Blake, who is sort of a knockoff Sherlock Holmes, if you will, although he certainly took on a life of his own for many, many years, and I think may still even be having some adventures come out in the United Kingdom, I'm not sure. But he started back in the 1890s, so he's been around forever in the dime novels.
I understand correctly, there's like 4,000 Sexton Blake stories or thereabouts.
I think you're right, Art. Yeah. You're right.
it's an amazing collection.
Amazing.
And amazing.
Absolutely.
Continuity for a single character to he's probably the world record character for being continuously in print and continuously having new stories from the very beginning.
You may be right. And anyone interested in more investigation of Sexton Blake should definitely check out Blakeyana.com. It's the best Sexton Blake website out there, although Jess Nevins also has a very good site. But I think probably Jess would even bow to the comprehensiveness of the Blakeyana.com site. It's a great site. It's actually hosted by a gentleman named Mark Hodder, who is now writing his own novels. What is the name of his novel? It would definitely be of interest to this audience. The Strange Affair of Spring-Heeled Jack is Mark Hodder's novel. It's a steampunk novel, and it's part of a series called Burton and Swinburne. So check that out on Amazon. I've heard good things about it. Sort of a steampunk type of series, I think. Anyway, so in my story, Holmes meets Sexton Blake. He also works with another Holmes knockoff. That was kind of the premise here, a knockoff called Harry Dixon. And Harry Dixon has been called the American Sherlock Holmes, although he's a French character, a character who originated in French and I believe even Dutch pulps. And you can go to Wikipedia to read the full story because there was this whole sort of really involved backstory of how the Holmes stories were originally reprinted and translated in Dutch, and then the magazine migrated to original stories, and then the Conan Doyle estate got upset, so they retitled him Harry Dixon, and then there were new Harry Dixon original stories, and on and on and on. And this is from the early 1900s through the 1930s.
That's a name that you can't make fun of.
I'm waiting for you to go ahead and make fun of it, Rick.
I'm trying to keep this a PG.
then I'll keep it PG also.
I'll leave that to Art.
So Holmes works with Sexton Blake, Harry Dixon. We see Holmes's brother Mycroft in the story, Mycroft Holmes. We go into the depths of the Diogenes Club, which is Mycroft Holmes's club, but which is also the secret headquarters of the British Secret Service. And I didn't make that up. That's been documented in many different Holmes past issues.
What is it? Charlie Strauss has done a few stories about the Diogenes Club, too.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That was in Alan Moore's Extraordinary Gentleman.
That's right. It was in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Kim Newman has written a series of Diogenes Club stories, which take place from the 1890s all the way through the present, through different generations of Diogenes Club agents. So I'm sort of playing with that. And then the last crossover character is actually a disguised character because there was a slight concern that this character might be under copyright. I couldn't really determine that with any certainty, so I changed the name. This character is a Sax Rohmer character, the daughter of a character of several short stories by Sax Rohmer, an investigator named Morris Claw. And the character appearing in my story is his daughter, Isis Claw, although I changed her last name, actually married her off and then made her a widow to give her a different surname. But if you read between the lines, it's Isis Claw. So.
Oh, very good. That's the dream detective, isn't it?
That's exactly right, the dreaming detective, yes. Morris Claw. Yep.
Yes. Rohmer has such an imagination. He had some terrific stories.
Fun stuff. And by using that, I actually get to play a little bit with Holmes's with sort of the paradigm that Holmes follows, which is, you know, there are no supernatural explanations. Harry Dixon's cases sometimes delved into the supernatural, and then you have this daughter of the dreaming detective, the daughter of the detective who dreams the solutions to cases. You know, so you know, imagine these characters sort of paired up with Holmes, and you get a sense of the fun that could ensue.
Oh yeah, oh that should be terrific. I'm looking forward to that one for sure.
So the reason you'll really like it, Art, is that the mystery takes place at Wold Newton.
Ah ha ha! Excellent.
And with that, I probably will not say any more.
Oh, that's a good enough hook. we should have some other things coming out that's related to crossovers this year as well.
Yep. We do. I've got a couple other things are in my hopper coming out later. We have a Zorro story in More Tales of Zorro from Moonstone Books. And this one is really pretty much a straight Zorro Avenger. There's one very, very subtle crossover in it, and I would just say that you would have to go and read the genealogies at Jean-Marc Lafcier's French Wold Newton genealogy site in order to discover this crossover. So sometimes I just like to go a little bit more conservative and bury the crossovers pretty deeply, and so I've done that. I have a Green Ghost story coming from Moonstone Books. It's a backup feature which will be in the Phantom Detective graphic novel, but it is a prose story which is illustrated with 8 or 9. Full-page illustrations. If you've seen some of Moonstone's other Phantom books where they that they produce in this quote-unquote wide vision format with very large illustrations, that's what the format is here. So we have a Green Ghost story. Definitely some crossovers in that. The story's called Zombies Under Broadway. So if you kind of go back to some of those zany zombie pictures from the 1940s, you might get a sense of some of the inspiration that's in this story, although the story itself is not what I would call zany. anything but zany. And then we have, I already spoke about The Adventure of the Fallen Stone. That's the Sherlock Holmes story. We have the Green Hornet Case Files coming out in a few months. This is the second volume of Green Hornet short stories, the first of which was the Green Hornet Chronicles that came out last October. And that volume definitely had some minor crossovers in it, things that are have to be pretty subtle for copyright concerns, but definitely some crossovers there, including a villainess, if you caught it in Howard Hopkins' story, with the last name of Cavendish. So if you've got a descendant of the Lone Ranger, i.e. the Green Hornet, going up against a descendant of a Cavendish, you can imagine what might happen there. And a couple of other crossovers in that. So with the Case Files, the second volume, haven't seen as many writers slipping in crossovers into their stories, although I haven't written my standalone story yet. So I'll definitely throw some stuff in there.
Super. Now, I know. I think that's half the fun of doing some of these anthologies is to try and slip in a couple of those. I know they did that for the Avenger Chronicles when they did the first volume, and that's really part of the fun of this is to try and bring all these characters together in the same universe and to have them interact.
Go ahead, Rick.
I'm gonna say, of course, the most obvious crossover for a Green Hornet would be that meshed Rider of the Plains, but that's something we'd never see.
Well, yeah, I mean, you would have to get both license holders to agree.
Right.
And that's kind of where the, I'm not sure if they've actually asked about that or not.
Well, plus the time difference too.
Right. But you could tell a story that begins with the Lone Ranger in his time frame,
right.
and then the mystery sort of ends, but yet it carries forward. Elements of it could carry forward to the Green Hornet's time frame.
Well, I mean, you also have the nephew of the Lone Ranger who is the father of the Green Hornet. So
right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So you could definitely tell a generational story there. That would be a lot of fun. And arts. Oh, I go ahead. I was just going to mention a little bit more in the Avenger art.
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
So I think you had mentioned the first Avenger anthology, and I just wanted to point out that there are two additional anthologies in the works. So the second volume, I think, is going to come out in a couple of months. I don't believe that I'm in that one, but I'm fairly certain that there's another writer whose name will be familiar to you, Art, but who I'm not going to name, who will have a writer, will have a story in that second volume of Avenger stories, and there's definitely a subtle Farmerian connection in that story. If that story doesn't make it into Volume 2, I don't see why it wouldn't be in Volume 3. Everything I've heard is that the story is definitely approved. It's just which volume is it going to be in. And then I believe that my own Avenger story, actually my second Avenger story, would be in Volume 3. I had one in Volume 1 as well. And if you read that art, you probably know that the villainess in that story was a villainess who was very prominent in one of Phil Farmer's novels.
Yes, indeed. And relevant in other series, shall we say.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes. very well done. That was another great story. And she's a villainess that's worthy of being there, you know.
I just I can't give up on that villainess art. There's something about her.
Well, it sounds like this it's going to be another big year. You're going to have a lot of things in the fire, and there's going to be a lot more inspired material from the Walt Newton universe and in the Crossovers universe. I was wondering, I think you had mentioned sometime that you were thinking of having your own novel in the Crossovers universe. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, I can. Well, actually, there's several novels that I'd like to write. And really, the Crossovers universe, the two books that make up the Crossovers timeline, the encyclopedias, which are told in a timeline format, really are my Bible to writing at this point, to writing within this universe. All I have to do is go back and look something up and say, oh, there's something that's never been explained. I think I'll write a story about that. There are all sorts of ideas that pop up, that pop into my brain as I look through the crossover chronology timeline. So that said, the next novel that I really have in the hopper will be a Sherlock Holmes novel. And it's going to be actually a sequel to the short story that we were just discussing in the crossover's casebook. So although that story definitely comes to an ending, it's not like it ends on a cliffhanger and you're going to be annoyed that the story ends. that's not what happens. But there are some elements from that short story that I can pick up with and devote to a whole novel. So I plan on writing a Sherlock Holmes novel. It's really more probably a novella length. My deadline for that, to turn that in, is probably around July or August of this year. So I'm hoping that it would see publication late this year or early next year. The series of novels, different authors tackling some different characters, that series of novels for which I'm doing the Sherlock Holmes piece has actually not been announced by the publisher yet, so I can't discuss any of the publication details, but it's definitely something that's moving forward. So that'll be my next big project, a Holmes novel. I'd definitely like to return to Patricia Wildman, who was the heroine of The Evil in Pemberley House, and write another novel about her. So I've definitely got some thoughts about that. And there's some other unfinished works by Philip Jose Farmer. I certainly would not want to lay claim to all of them because there are many talented writers out there who have, I believe, the talent and the knowledge to complete some of Phil's unfinished works. But I may wish to tackle one or two of those in the next couple of years, if I can get permission from the family and the estate to proceed with that. I wouldn't want to write them without permission, I'm hopeful that I'll be able to proceed with that in the next couple of years.
Well, that would be wonderful. You know, we've talked about some of these stories before, both online a little bit and offline, and some of those stories are of great interest to those of us who have been fans of Phil's pulp period, especially his Lord Grunith and Doc Caliban series. So,
right.
It would be wonderful to actually get some closure on the series the way Phil had wanted it to be. And my only hope is that I will live long enough to see it.
Well, I think you're going to be with us for quite a while, Art. So
a few more years.
Well, you know what they say, Art? The good die young. That means you'll live forever.
Yeah.
Couldn't resist that one.
I know.
Art with friends like these.
Yeah.
Forget the enemies.
Exactly.
Well, it's as I said, it's going to be a good year, and we have a lot to look forward to. I know you and I have known each other. Gosh, it must be, we're going on 15 years now. We first encountered each other on the web with interest in Will Newton studies, and on our love of Phil Farmer. I'm hoping that we're going to see a lot more good material. Phil's work has enduring value. And I'm hoping to see more of it coming back into print. We've talked before about the only major prose work of his there's a couple that haven't come back in. The major one is the Doc Savage biography. I'd love to see a new edition of that. There also was an anthology called Mother Was a Lovely Beast,
right,
which I'm sure you're familiar with. This was a wonderful anthology that collected some very interesting pulp stories about feral children.
Yeah.
And it also had some other material from Phil's interview with the real Tarzan and an essay on the linguistics of how Tarzan learned to read. That was always one of my favorites. When I was in medical school, I had a couple of copies of hardcover copies of Tarzan Alive, the Doc Savage autobiography, and of Mother Was a Lovely Beast. I had one that I kept at home in New Jersey and one that I kept in my desk at medical school because I wanted to have them there for ready reference at any time.
That's right. That's right. There's some there's some books you just have to have two or even three copies of.
Yeah.
And you're right.
Yeah, I've had more than that, and my wife keeps wondering, why do you have so many of these things? Isn't Wild good enough?
No, because you have to have every edition and every cover.
That's exactly right.
What's so hard about that?
Yeah. Oh well, I understand now why some people say their wife doesn't understand them.
But yeah.
In the other case, my wife understands me sometimes all too well.
All too well. She gets it. She gets it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm also hopeful that we'll see a reprinting of the Doc Savage biography here soon. It's been far too long, as you said, Art. Tarzan Alive was reprinted in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
But the Doc Savage biography, Doc Savage's Apocalyptic Life, say that three times fast. I think the last time that was out in print was 1981. So that's been far too long to be out of print. I agree.
Yeah, and well, we'll be looking forward to something happening about that. It'll be the 80th anniversary. Oh yeah, me too. The 80th anniversary is coming up, and that would be an ideal time. You know, I think one of the sad things with the DC comic version of Doc Savage falling through is that when something like that happens, it kind of loses interest in the character. Had that been successful, we would have had more momentum, and you know, we could have looked forward to a film and other things. But as it stands, nevertheless, there's a very strong fan base, and I would hope that the companies would recognize this, and that you know, next time they want to start one of these with an established character, they try not to alienate the already established fan base and to try and get them on their side in the beginning.
I completely agree, Art, and you're right. The failure of the Doc Savage comic, the latest one from DC, is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it just wasn't very good, and it made unnecessary changes to the Doc Savage mythos and to Doc's time and place. And tried to force him into this first wave alternate universe, which was just unnecessary. On the con side, though, you're right. Unfortunately, the world at large may interpret the failure of the comic book as the failure of the character itself, right, rather than the failure of the execution of this particular comic book. And that's definitely a scary thing, because I think that there's still a huge potential in Doc Savage for real, true Doc Savage novels, which we're supposedly going to be getting from Will Murray anytime now, and I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. But you know, a real true Doc Savage film that honors the character and the stories without poking fun at the character. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of potential there, but for some reason, very few adaptations have ever really hit the mark.
Yeah, you know, I think the closest that anybody came to really capturing the pulpish spirit was the Indiana Jones series.
Yeah.
And if you read what Spielberg did, he was inspired to do it by the stories of Doc Savage and other pulp characters. But he was looking for someone a little bit more vulnerable and someone that he thought would give a better storyline. But, you know, there was a commitment to the character. There was a love of the character and of the genre, you know, from a top filmmaker. And that makes all the difference in the world. You know, somebody like Sam Raimi, I think, could do a marvelous job with this character.
Yep.
You know, and when Sam's at the top of his game, he does excellent films. The Spider-Man films were very good. His movie, The Quick and the Dead, was a wonderful ensemble piece with a lot of different, very odd characters to it. You know, that's one of the things with Doc Savage, is that the characters were always, there were always very different personalities. They were always a little bit on the odd side. There was a lot of personality in it. And somebody that had that the touch that made The Quick and the Dead could do a good job with a Doc Savage story.
So, yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, people look at pulp or at pulp-inspired films like Indiana Jones, and then they say, well, you can't make one without the humor. Look at the humor that's in the Indiana Jones films. The problem with that argument is that the Indiana Jones films derive their humor from the situations, not from making fun of the character itself. Just like the travesty of this latest Green Hornet film, it could have been an action comedy, which is how it was positioned. But it could have been an action comedy that honored the characters by finding humor in the situations, rather than making fun of the character itself, and by turning the character into someone that he was not originally intended to be. It's just very unfortunate that when people get a hold of these properties for filmmaking purposes, they somehow feel that they need to alter the characters rather than just writing a darn good story.
Exactly. Amen. Well, hopefully they'll learn their lessons.
I'm not holding my breath. Yeah.
Hope springs eternal.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, I think we've covered an awful lot of things today. It's always a pleasure and an honor to have you on the show, Wynn. You're the great granddaddy of the Will Newton universe and now of the Crossovers universe. And hopefully, as you have said, you are using your Crossovers books as a Bible to help guide your story writing in the future in the Crossover universe. Hopefully we'll see more people who will do the same thing, and we can create a unified, our own version of a, quote, first wave, close quote, universe that actually hangs together. And
exactly.
Needs something.
I like the way you think, Art.
Well, they could have done that first wave, but said it, earlier time.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. The whole period, the 1930s is a very fascinating period of history. It's on the cusp of a number of social changes. It's on the cusp of international change, of technological change. I'm just sitting here thinking that somebody with a little creativity could really run with that and get you a relevant storyline that's not only a good story, but that says something. Hopefully we will inspire somebody someday to do that right thing, and we'll get the right storyline out of it.
I agree. There's no reason on earth not to set a series of stories in the 1930s and still have them be fun and relevant. I think the spirit comics that they set in the first wave were not bad, and certainly not as bad as some of the others. The Doc Savage, they were okay, but again, the changes were unnecessary. The Avenger backup story completely changed the character. I mean, changed the character so much, and the backup characters, the assistants, or Benson's teammates, so much that there was literally no point in DC paying good money to Condé Nast for the rights to use the Avenger.
Oh, yeah.
Because it wasn't the Avenger in any way, shape, or form.
In name only.
In name only. Terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible stuff.
Yeah. And,
sorry. I'm sorry. I get very... I get a little worked up. Sorry.
I agree with you there. That was a big misstep. And I often wonder, why do they even bother paying the royalties if they want to do their own character?
Exactly.
The only reason to really do an established character is to, number one, you want to trade on the already established fan base in order to gain an immediate audience and build from there. And that was something that they didn't do. And then number
right.
two, you've got a formula that works. We know that it works. Why do we have to go screw with it? Why can't we just leave the formula be?
Exactly, Art. It makes no sense for no matter which way you approach it from a logical perspective, it makes no sense. If you want to trade on the character's name, the Avenger, well, let's face it, I love the Avenger, but a minor pulp character. This more of a second mm-hmm. string, certainly not as well known from a name perspective as Doc Savage or The Shadow or Tarzan, right? A great, great pulp character, but more of that second line. So not a ton of name recognition there anyway. And then look at the name confusion. Is it the Avengers, the Marvel Super Team? No. Is it the Avengers? Is it John Steed and Emma Peel, the British? No, this is a different one. This is the Avenger. Oh, the Avenger. Who's that? So there's no name recognition to trade on there. So why'd they pay money for that? And except to appeal to a small fan base, and then they turn around and alienate that fan base. It makes no sense.
Or I mean, if you go into the paperbacks, there's a few of the Aggressor novels. You know, mm-hmm. there's two different ones. Because I was looking in the bookstore just yesterday and saw, like, The Avenger, but it was written, I think, in the 80s as an Aggressor novel. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, exactly. No matter which way you approach it, they badly misstepped there, and their whatever their strategy is, it's not discernible to people who operate in a logical real world.
Right. Well, hopefully somebody somewhere has learned something from this experience, and we can expect something better in the future. Please.
At least we have the Moonstone. At least we have the Moonstone.
Oh yes.
Books.
Oh yeah. I have to give Moonstone credit. I think that they have resurrected a number of characters, and they've done it correctly. They have stayed with the original idea of the character. In many cases, they have maintained the original setting of the character, and they've respected the already established fan base, and they seem to be doing great. They're expanding their lines in the midst of our economic downturn, and right. they seem to be doing very well. You know, hint, hint, hint. Yeah. Well, I guess that's kind of going to wrap us up for this evening.
Very good. Could I make just one last plug then?
Oh, absolutely. Make as many as you want.
So this is actually for a book that's going to come out sometime this year that I am not in, but I think it's very, very well worth plugging. It's going to be The Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer 2.
Wonderful.
So The Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer 1 came out last June. This will be a similar collection, a similar anthology. The subtitle right now is being debated, so I'm not going to talk about what the subtitle is. But it will be the second collection. It will have new stories by some authors set in some of Philip Jose Farmer's worlds, again, licensed by the Philip Jose Farmer estate. It will have more nuggets of previously unpublished pieces by Philip Jose Farmer from what we call the magic filing cabinet of a treasure trove of stories and articles and speeches from Phil's files. It will be edited again by Michael Croteau, who is the webmaster of the official Philip Jose Farmer page, and he edited the first book. In terms of the contents, I'm not going to speak about that right now because it's still a little bit in flux and mm-hmm. The guys are nailing things down, but I just wanted to get that on people's radar. If you liked Volume 1, definitely keep your eyes open for Volume 2. And then in terms of FarmerCon this year, I just wanted to note there will be a FarmerCon this year. It will either be in Seattle around the last week of June, or it will be in Columbus, Ohio, in conjunction with Pulp Fest in the last week of July. And right now, that's an either-or for some things that we really can't go into yet. But we're asking that people who are interested in FarmerCon this year to just take a look at keeping both of those weekends open in their calendars. And then Mike and the rest of us farmer folks will communicate more definite plans as soon as we possibly can.
Excellent. Oh, I was there at the FarmerCon last year. We had such a good time up there in Seattle, the Locust people. That was an amazing group of folks. I got to see some of my favorite authors. Connie Willis was there, Mike Bishop. Oh, gosh. what's her name? Nancy. She was the one. She and Connie Willis are good friends, and Connie was always teasing her. But it was a wonderful time, and that was a great chance. You know, all us old Will Newton fans got together. You know, John Small and Mike and Paul Spiteri came, and we had, and Chris Carey, of course, lives up there, and his wife Laura came. So
right.
That was a lot of fun. I really look forward to the next PharmaCon. We'll see how it goes.
We will see how it goes. It was a great time, and we definitely appreciate the Locust folks opening up their doors to us last year. So
they're very
we'll
gracious,
see what happens.
Very gracious. You know, that's also, we should mention that the Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer, the first volume is published by Meteoric Press.
Meteor House.
Meteor House, I'll get it right. Meteor
House, okay.
and they're going to be doing the second volume as well, I think, aren't they?
That's right. Meteor House. Mm-hmm. And all you need to do is point your browser to www.meteorhouse.com, and the book is still available for order there. So still have copies on hand. And also, Mike, the editor, has been putting short excerpts online, and you can read many excerpts of many of the pieces at MeteorHouse.com, or you can become a friend of Meteor House on Facebook. Just search for Meteor House.
Oh, very good. All righty. Well, I guess that wraps things up for today.
All right.
We're so pleased to have you on again, Wynn. We look forward to talking to you again in the future. Maybe after PharmaCon, we'll have an opportunity to talk again about the new volumes and other things that may be in the works by that time.
All right.
You know, please have a very, very good evening, and say hello to your lovely wife.
I sure will.
You know, she's been to a couple of the conferences, and you know, she's another one. She's a good lady. She puts up with us and with our with our little foibles. So,
she
you know,
does.
Sometimes we forget about the wives. My wife is long-suffering as well. And you know, the power couple was Phil Farmer and Betty. You know,
they definitely were. And Betty was a big presence and definitely one that you would not want to ignore. She was definitely one to be reckoned with, but a lovely, lovely and gracious and welcoming lady who I can't say enough was just as much responsible for having us all there for the PharmaCons as Phil himself was. We couldn't have done it without either one of them.
Mm. Very good. Well, then, I guess that's going to wrap us up. This is Art Cipo.
And Rick Croxton.
And you are leaving the Book Cave. Have a pleasant evening.
Bye. Guys, thanks very much. Thank you.
All right.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.